with oral argument on this Commonwealth appeal. Mr. Chandeville, do you want to reserve any rebuttal?
Reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Chandeville. I represent the Commonwealth and as the appellant in this appeal. This is a case in which proper application of three controlling legal principles really makes all the difference. Properly applied, Deputy Davidson had reasonable, articulable suspicion that Mr. Rosser was may have been engaging in criminal activity when he made the stop. Improperly applied, and improper results follow, as was demonstrated by the trial court's decision here and by Mr. Rosser's arguments on appeal.
Mr. Chandeville, this is Judge Petty. Do you agree that we're going to treat this as an anonymous tip in our analysis?
We believe it would be fair to treat it as an anonymous tip in your analysis. I don't know that there's case law out there right now that requires you to do so, but that seems to be the way the courts have treated these scenarios in the past.
I think we did that in Ramey versus Commonwealth.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Go ahead.
And the U.S. Supreme Court in Navarrete basically did the same thing. There's a footnote there that demonstrated the courts had treated it as an anonymous tip, even though there was no indication in the record as to whether or not it was truly anonymous, the 911 call there. So I think it's fair to treat this analysis as an anonymous tip. The first of these three controlling legal principles that needs to be applied in these scenarios is that the reasonable suspicion standard takes into account the totality of the circumstances for the entire picture.
Reasonable suspicion of what? What criminal activity are we talking about? I mean,
we have a
quote: "Be on the lookout connected with drug activity." What information does that convey to the officer?
Well, that conveys the officer that there is some sort of criminal activity involving drugs, which is ongoing. Which Mr.
Now, okay, let me stop you there because that was my next question. How do you know that it's ongoing as opposed to completed?
Well, I guess we don't know that it's ongoing as opposed to completed.
How do we know that the defendant is involved in drug activity as opposed to perhaps being a witness that the sergeant wanted to talk to?
Well, just based on the BOLO report, we might not yet know that, but the totality of circumstances test requires looking at whether or not his evasive behavior corroborates the tip. And so just someone who's wanting to be investigated as a witness would not try to evade contact with law enforcement in the way it was reasonable, I think, to conclude
that. It's kind of a supposition, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of witnesses involved in drug cases that aren't particularly friendly with the police.
Correct, Your Honor. There are some suppositions that have to be made, but we allow officers to make those inferences and suppositions based on their knowledge, training, experience in the field.
Yeah, so this is Judge Frank. You would agree, I would think, that in this tip there was no information as to source of knowledge.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And there was also nothing in this tip which was predictive, at least not read in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below, which is Mr. Rosser. So the question then becomes, was there anything that the officer observed which corroborated this tip, and which corroborated an allegation and a reasonable suspicion that there was criminal activity that may have been afoot that Mr. Rosser was involved in? So the question is, you know, does the evasive driving and his officer's observations of evasive driving corroborate that there may be some criminal activity going on here? But the trial court didn't ask that question. The trial court, instead of asking whether the combined weight of the two equals reasonable suspicion, applied what we're calling an improper litmus test based on the court's interpretation of at least Neal versus Commonwealth, probably Harris versus Commonwealth as well. And what the trial court basically said was the only way to corroborate a non-predictive anonymous tip is by an officer's observation in an individual engaging in the specific type of criminal activity alleged in the tip. And we know that that's frankly just not the law from plenty of Virginia cases and U.S. Supreme Court cases. I believe it's Hatcher versus Commonwealth, which states that the officer doesn't actually need to have any suspicion of a specific criminal activity, just that some criminal activity is afoot generally. if you look at cases like Gregory versus Commonwealth, which is a Virginia Court of Appeals case, there the anonymous tip only alleged that there was a man in the street flagging down passing cars and offering to sell drugs. And when the officer showed up, the only thing...
This is Judge Frank, but in Gregory, there was a detailed description of the defendant and the car. And within minutes of the tip, he corroborated the car, the clothes, high drug area, and so forth.
Right, and in this case, we have fewer details about the defendant. We have two. We have that he's a male and that he's bald. But we also have six innocent details which were alleged in the tip, each of which the officer was able to corroborate in his investigation. And those tips are the color, those details are the color, make, model of the car, gold Nissan Maxima, the fact that it would be in the area of Red House Road, the location, the time frame in which it would appear, that's five.
Now let me ask you about traveling. The time frame. I'm not sure exactly when that be on the lookout was broadcast. It's very vague. Am I correct there?
You're correct there, and especially read in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I mean, to the prevailing party, which is Mr. Rosser, we can't say when the bolo came in and when the tip was received. However, the officer did testify on page 25 of the appendix that the bolo report alleged that the car would appear in a specific time frame, and the car actually did appear.
Well, he doesn't say specific time frame. He says, he advised me of the car, which was to be in the area of Red House Road in that time frame, but he never says what time frame.
He doesn't say what time frame, but I think that implies that the time frame in which the car did appear was the time frame alleged in the report.
And, of course, we're construing all of these facts in a light most favorable to the prevailing party, so that if it appears that the trial judge did not draw the inferences that you wish us to draw from that testimony.
That's correct. So I think we, in the light most favorable to Mr. Rosser, have to assume that this tip came in right before it was actually observed. It could have been someone standing out in the street, saw Mr. Rosser's car passing, and just described some innocent details. None of those details were predictive. I think that it's definitely fair to say, especially in the light most favorable to Mr. Rosser. However, we don't just have a tip. We have the tip which Officer Deputy Davidson is able to corroborate by corroborating the innocent details and by observing Mr. Rosser engaged in evasive behavior. And we know from the case law that evasive behavior can be an indicator of guilt. And so the evasive behavior indicated that he may have been involved in some sort of criminal activity. When you combine that with the tip that he was engaged in a specific type of criminal activity, then we're arguing that the two together viewed in their totality constitute reasonable suspicion that criminal activity may have been afoot. That's what the court did in Gregory. The court pointed out the fact that the officer did not observe Mr. Gregory engaging in any sort of actual drug distribution. He just got out of his car and walked away when the officer showed up. But the court in Gregory said that evasive behavior plus the tip was sufficient to constitute reasonable suspicion. Another case, Smith versus Commonwealth. In that case, this court said that an anonymous tip with no predictive information, like we have here, plus the officer's observations of evasive behavior at the scene, in that case actually rose to the level of probable cause.
I think this Navarette case is quite instructive, and it starts with the proposition that it seems to almost establish a floor below which you cannot go in determining a tip to be reliable. It calls it a close case. Justice Thomas calls it a close case. And in Navarette, we've got evidence of that the activity was observed by the tipster because it was called in. We've got the reliability of the use of the 911 system. There is an inference, apparently, that the trier of fact did draw that it was ongoing criminal activity, drunk driving, as opposed to a past episode of mere recklessness. But all of those kinds of criteria are missing from the case before us.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why don't we, if Navarrete
had was the tip. As the court pointed out, and the dissent was very quick to point out, the officers investigating the Navarrete's driving did not observe any suspicious behavior whatsoever. Justice Scalia, in his footnote, even mentioned the fact that there wasn't any sort of evasive behavior such as turning around to see if he was being followed. In our case, we do have observations of evasive behavior, and Deputy Davidson testified that based on his training in drug interdiction, that this behavior on the part of Mr. Rosser was evasive.
But that evasive behavior is just an indication of the reliability of the tip, isn't it? It's not in and of itself sufficient. Are you arguing that evasive driving was in and of itself sufficient to warrant the stop?
I would argue that based on cases like Alston versus Commonwealth, the evasive driving by itself may have been sufficient to justify the stop, but we don't need to answer that question because we have the tip plus the evasive driving, and the evasive driving corroborates the tip in this case.
But the tip is not useful unless it's somehow established to be reliable.
You're right about that. But one of the ways that a tip can be established to be reliable is through the officer's observations of behavior, such as evasive behavior, which are indicative that some criminal activity may be afoot. So you're correct. There have to be some indicia of reliability for an anonymous tip. But one way of doing that is, as the officer did here, by observing that evasive behavior. That's what the court did in Gregory. That's what the court did in Smith. That's what the Fourth Circuit did in Sims. That's what the Fourth Circuit did in McCoy. So anonymous tips, which are non-predictive, plus corroboration of evasive behavior, can be sufficient to rise this above a close case.
How do we review the trial court's determination or apparently conclusion that this behavior wasn't evasive?
Well, I think obviously we have to, you know, all factual findings are read in the light most favorable to Mr. Rosser, and all reasonable inferences are read in the light most favorable to Mr. Rosser. I think there's an argument to be made that the trial court did not actually make a factual finding as to whether or not he was driving evasively. The court just said he could have been driving just carefully, basically. And there's an argument to be made that if the court did make an inference that he actually was not driving evasively at all, that that wasn't a reasonable inference in light of Deputy Davidson's testimony based on his training and experience. However, putting those arguments aside, I really don't think the question of whether or not Mr. Rosser, in his own mind, was really attempting to drive evasively, I don't really think that question is relevant to the legal standard that this court is called upon to apply here, and that the trial court had to apply, which was viewed from the perspective of the officer, of Deputy Davidson, was it reasonable for him to conclude that Mr. Rosser was driving evasively? The trial court in this case did not ask that question and did not answer that question.
Counsel, this is Judge Frank. You're into your rebuttal. You have about 3 minutes left. You can continue or you can reserve the rest of it for rebuttal.
I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, Judge.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Davies.
Yes, Your Honor, this is Jordan Davies. I represent
Mr. Davies, this is,
yes,
Judge,
sir.
Betty. Are you on speakerphone?
I am. I'm off it now, though.
There you go. Thank you very much. It's hard to ask questions.
Is that better?
Sometimes with speakerphone. That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. I apologize for my voice. I'm getting over a cough, but I'll do my best. I represent Kevin Rosser in this case, and our argument essentially is the trial court did not err in holding that Deputy Davidson of the Sheriff's Office lacked reasonable articulable suspicion to stop the vehicle. Obviously, we're saying that he did not. So as the Commonwealth rightly says, this is an anonymous tip coupled with what they're calling evasive behavior. Our argument, and we would agree with the trial court, is that the two legal right turns without anything more cannot be considered evasive. Judge White essentially determined that that was not evasive driving. It was essentially legal driving that the officer opined, in his opinion, that it was evasive. So what we have is a tip, and again, the Commonwealth said, you know, we don't know where it came from. We don't know if it was an informant. We don't know if it was someone on the street. We don't know if it was from something that was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, you know, 4 weeks ago, 1 year ago. All we have is that there's a bolo that says there's a gold Nissan Maxima. It's going to be in the area of Red House Road. There's a male in there. He's bald. There's nothing about race. And all that it says is that the vehicle, not even the defendant, is connected with drug activity. So based on that, Deputy Davidson sees the car, sees him make two legal right turns, and pulls him over. We would submit that the judge, the trial court, made the right decision and stopped in saying that there was no reasonable, articulable suspicion. And again, the court does apply the totality of the circumstances test. The Commonwealth says it applied the wrong test, but it certainly did apply the totality of the circumstances test. And the Commonwealth cites to Gregory, it cites to Smith, it cites to Halston, cites to Navarrete, cites to all these cases. This instant case, Rosser, can be distinguished easily from all those cases. And Gregory, obviously, was an anonymous call, but it was at 2 a.m. It said that there was someone standing in the roadway dealing in drugs. That's way more specific. When the police show up, the defendant walked away. He looked behind. He made eye contact with the officer. In this case, I think I asked Deputy Davidson, and he says he doesn't know for sure if the defendant made eye contact. He's not speeding. He's not swerving.
What about the fact that he turned into a driveway, a residence that wasn't his,
right?
And then backed out came out and proceeded again in the same direction?
Right. And on its own,
suspicious in some sense?
I would submit it's not, Your Honor, and because Deputy Davidson did testify, he knows the Jamersons. Many of yours may not know, the Jamersons are a prominent family in Appomattox, but all he said is he knows the Jamersons, but he doesn't know who the Jamersons know. All he knows is that there's a turn into a private driveway. He could have been there visiting. He could have been lost. He could have been dropping something off at the Jamersons' house. The point is, Deputy Davidson kept going. He didn't investigate that because at that point it probably wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. And like I said, he could have been dropping something off in the mailbox. That only takes a matter of seconds. He could have done that, back out, and proceeded the way he was going. I would submit that's not...
This is Judge Frank, but the case law is clear that there could be innocent explanations for a lot of suspicious activity, but that doesn't mean that it eliminates reasonable suspicion.
That's true. And sorry, Your Honor.
No, you agree with that?
I agree with that. And again, it's a totality of the circumstances test. You know, if we had that fact, that he pulled into a driveway that wasn't his, plus something else, plus something else, plus something else, plus something else, that could rise to the level of reasonable, articulable suspicion. But we have that plus one other legal right turn, which we would submit is not enough. And again, it's articulable suspicion. The officer says it's evasive, but as I pointed out in my brief, he doesn't say why. He just says a turn is enough. He says it's based on his training and experience, but he doesn't point to anything because he wasn't asked. What about his training and experience led him to conclude that? He says it was drug interdiction, but there's really no causal connection. So anyone driving on the road that day that makes arguably two legal right turns could be pulled over. One for the driveway, one for the side street, and that's it. So that was my earlier point, that the bolo talked about drug activity. What does this even mean? Does it mean that the defendant was involved, that the vehicle was involved, that he had seen something, that there were drugs in the car, that there were drugs in the trunk? Again, we just don't know. There's not enough information. You know, one of the Your Honors made the point, well, what crime is being investigated? We just don't know. There wasn't anything specific like the defendant is going to be carrying marijuana. The defendant was seen with marijuana. The defendant will have cocaine, whatever it is. We just don't know. And again, it's a very vague tip. Again, we don't know when it was made, but there's no name. A lot of these other cases cited by the Commonwealth, the informant knows the name of the driver. They didn't know the name. A lot of cases have the license plate, like Harris v. Commonwealth, which is a Supreme Court, Virginia Supreme Court case. They had the license plate. Here we don't. Like I said, we don't even have the race of the individual. And Harris v. Commonwealth, that was a case where there was an anonymous tip for an intoxicated driver. So the informant gave the name, the license number, the make and model. And so the officer gets that tip and he follows. And all he sees are the brake lights flashing three times. The driver slows at an intersection. He slows again about 50 feet before. And then he slows finally and pulls over on his own accord. The Supreme Court of Virginia held that there was no reasonable, articulable suspicion in that case. I would submit that this case is similar in that there's a tip, but again, it's a low-level tip. We don't know where it's from. And then again, as I asked Deputy Davidson on cross, you know, what was he doing? He wasn't swerving. He wasn't speeding. He wasn't doing really anything illegal. I would submit that calling two legal right turns evasive. You know, the torts, especially the federal torts, talk about that. You know, just calling something evasive without more is not enough. And that's really what it is. I would make the argument it's probably difficult to be abrupt and evasive while also making or using your turn signal. Using your turn signal sort of eliminates that abruptness or evasiveness. You're essentially telling the person behind you or in front of you, depending on where you're coming from, hey, I'm going to turn, and I'm going to turn right now or shortly. And that's the whole point of the turn signal. He does that. The officer sees it. He makes the turn. It's not a case where he uses his right turn signal and then makes an abrupt left. He uses his right turn signal and makes the right. And the second right is when he's pulled over. And again, based on the totality of the circumstances, we would submit that's not enough. It's not reasonable. It's not articulable. There's really nothing about the tip that corroborates his activity. Nothing specifically dealing with drug dealing or drug interaction or drug activity that supports the officer's stop. So the Commonwealth says, I thought they said that evasive behavior is not enough. It's the tip plus the evasiveness. I would submit that's just not present. If it was a tip plus evasiveness, looking backwards, you know, speeding up, something like that, maybe that would be enough. But in this case, I would submit it's just not. It's just not enough. The trial court determined it wasn't enough. We're asking the court to agree with the trial court, to uphold the trial court's decision. She weighed the facts. She weighed the credibility of the witnesses. She heard the case, and she essentially, she didn't apply the wrong test. She applied the totality of the circumstances test, and in her opinion, based on what she heard, she determined it's not enough. And so she granted our motion to suppress, and that's what we're asking the court to do today.
Court have any questions?
No questions.
Okay. Mr. Davies, thank you, and we will hear from the Attorney General. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I could just talk briefly about...
Let me ask you this question. This is Judge Frank again. But for the evasive driving, would you still argue there was reasonable suspicion?
But for the evasive driving, I would allow that we probably don't have a
need the two viewed together in their totality, which
right.
is what
okay.
the test requires. Viewed by itself, the evasive driving by itself might have been enough. If you look at cases like Commonwealth versus Eves, for example, that was a Commonwealth appeal, and so the facts were read in the same light there as they're being read here. In that case, all you had was an abrupt U-turn close to a checkpoint and a last-second turn signal for that turn. And the court in that case held that that behavior was evasive enough. And there were, remember, there was no tip in that case. And the court held that that behavior was evasive enough to create reasonable suspicion.
If a police officer followed somebody down the road and they made two right turns, would that warrant reasonable suspicion to pull them over? Because, I mean, you're gonna make a turn sooner or later.
Right, no. That would not warrant reasonable suspicion.
Okay,
the only
what,
way it would,
what is different here?
The difference here is that the officer, based on the tip that he's received, can reasonably infer that the reason why this individual is making these abrupt turns is because he is actually involved in drug activity. He's trying to evade contact with the police. The analysis in Smith versus Commonwealth about why evasive behavior is such good corroboration of an anonymous tip is very relevant. I pointed out in my brief because someone on the side of the road who just sees someone walking by or driving by might be able to describe the vehicle and who's driving it. But that person would not be able to predict that Mr. Rosser would respond to the presence of police officer in the evasive manner that he did. So that is why it's such good corroboration of the anonymous tip. And why the two combined, again, the totality of the circumstances, which is what's required here, why the two combined create reasonable suspicion that criminal activity may have been afoot at the time that Deputy Davidson made the stop. Unless there are any further questions, we will
have any other questions?
No further. Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you for your argument, and I hope you have a nice day.
Thank you.
You too.
Y'all too.